The World is supported by LegalZoom for those wanting to start a business or secure their family's future. From wills and trusts to LLCs and trademarks, LegalZoom is committed to helping people get started. LegalZoom.com/world.
Abuse survivors and their church, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. At the Vatican Summit on Clergy Sex Abuse, survivors take the church to task.
And I said to the Archbishop, well, why don't you, rise to the occasion or be the leader?
Also, musicians line up to help the people of Venezuela.
This concert is all about bringing much-needed relief to Venezuela. It's all about making a difference to the lives of millions who have been suffering for far too long.
And the Oscar-nominated directors of the film Free Solo.
It's not a story about, a daredevil who has a death wish.
But it is a story about what it means to take really big risks. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World.
Dinanzi alla piaga degli abusi sessuali.
Pope Francis addressed bishops and other church leaders from around the world this week. They're gathered for a summit about the clergy sex abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. There are two more days of meetings to go. Phil Saviano is at the summit in Rome. He lives in Boston, and he's a survivor of clergy sex abuse. We spoke with him earlier this week, and we wanted to check in with him again about the meetings so far. Phil, at this summit meeting, Pope Francis has provided bishops 21 reflection points. I have the list right here, and one of the first points is to make a practical handbook of steps to be taken by authorities when cases of sex abuse happen at church. What do you think about that?
Well, by authorities, I assume he means bishops. And that's a great idea, but it really amazes me that such a handbook doesn't already exist, that it hasn't been in place for, 20, 30 years.
Have you looked at this list of reflection points?
I have. I wish I had the list in front of me, but I read it through quite closely last night.
What do you think of it? When you read it, do you think this is a good thing, or do you think some things are missing?
Well, I was relieved to see that it was described as just a number of topics for them to think about and a way to sort of start conversations and, directions that they might head into. If this was a list of policies and procedures that they wanted to put in place, I would have been horrified. I mean, there are a few good things. They call for, treating survivors with care and with respect. One of them, I forget which number it was, talks about how to deal with false allegations of abuse, which just makes me crazy, because I've been hearing that phrase ever since the early 90s when I went public, that there were people that were saying, this didn't really happen. These people are just looking for money. They're just trying to, find ways to get money off the Catholic Church. And for a survivor to find the courage to go forward, speak of their childhood experiences in a public manner and then be told this has to be a false allegation.
What you refer to, it's written in these set of points. It says, the right to defense, the principle of natural and canon law of presumption of innocence must also be safeguarded until the guilt of the accused is proven. I mean, in some ways that is, that is a legitimate thing. It's not completely denouncing a charge of abuse. It's simply saying, we have to prove it.
Right. And that's true in any, with any criminal charge, it does have to be proved. The question is, who's going to be doing the investigation? Who's going to be proving it one way or another?
Phil, the Pope says he wants concrete measures to be taken. You told us earlier this week that one of your main concerns is that mandated reporting needs to happen. Remind us what that is and whether you think the Catholic Church is moving in that direction to require that.
Mandated reporting essentially means that if a bishop learns that one of the priests within his diocese has been abusing a child or an adolescent, since this is criminal behavior that we're talking about, it should be reported to civil authorities, namely the police. And if there's an investigation to be done, it should be done by people who are trained to do such investigations, namely the police. And I talked to Archbishop Sikliner about that at our survivors meeting on Tuesday. And I was really kind of dismayed with his answer. What, I think the policy that they want to follow is that if it is mandated by law in the particular country where the abuse is happening, they will follow the law and they will report it to civil authorities. But unless it's mandated by law, they're not going to report it. And I said to the Archbishop, well, why don't you, you know, rise to the occasion or be the leader and say to the governments where this is not a law that it should be a law and that we're going to start reporting whether it's a law or not, because it would be a great thing for the church to take the lead on. And he was not really interested in hearing that that point of view.
One thing I want to get clarity on is your definition of mandated reporting when a bishop hears that there has been sexual abuse or when it's been proven?
I think it's when the bishop hears about it.
So you think if a bishop hears there's been sexual abuse, that a priest has sexually abused anyone in the church, that the charge should immediately be reported to authorities, civil authorities, and then go from there?
No, that's absolutely what I believe. And let the civil authorities do the investigation. And if it turns out to be a false charge, well, the civil authorities will figure that out.
One thing that struck me was that at the first meeting, which was yesterday, there were pre-recorded testimonials by survivors of clergy sex abuse. Why wasn't it live? Do you know?
Well, I don't know for a fact. I can tell you that if I was a survivor and I was asked to give testimony, it would be a lot easier to do it into a microphone than it would be to stand on a stage or sit behind a table facing an audience of roughly 200 bishops and cardinals. I mean, it can be very, very difficult for survivors to talk about these experiences at all. And from what I read, some of the testimonies that were presented, pre-recorded, were quite graphic about their experiences. And I think that, I mean, I don't know for a fact, but I suspect that one of the reasons why the testimony was given not in person but by videotape was in part to protect the survivor who was speaking. Protect their emotional, psychological health, not put them in a position where they're so nervous that they can hardly get the details of their story out. The other thing is that they didn't identify who any of these survivors were. No names were given. And I think that if they were testifying in person, it would have been a little bit more difficult to keep their identities shielded.
Phil, there's two more days of this summit. What are you looking for?
What I'm looking for and what I'm going to get, I think, are two different things. But what I'm hoping for is that this will be the beginning of what's going to be a not too long process. My understanding was that the main objective of this 4-day summit was to bring bishops from other parts of the world who feel that they don't have any abuse problem within their jurisdiction, bringing them up to speed on the fact that they probably do. It's just that the victims in those countries haven't found their voices. And educate these bishops on what abuse is all about, what it does to the child emotionally, what it does to the child spiritually, that abuse, the abuser should be pulled out of service so that he doesn't have the possibility of abusing other children. I think that when the meeting is over on Sunday, I know that the Pope's going to make a presentation to the public. I don't expect that he's going to, at that point, come out with any significant changes. But I am hopeful that this summit is the beginning of a series of conferences, a series of discussions, and plans to start putting regulations in place.
Phil Saviano is a survivor of clergy sex abuse. He's also an activist on the issue and has been for many years. He's been speaking with us from Rome. Phil, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Carol.
Hola, Cúcuta! Bienvenidos a Venezuela Live!
On the border between Venezuela and Colombia today, thousands gathered for a special concert. It took place in Cúcuta, Colombia, and it was dubbed, as you just heard, Venezuela Aid Live. One of the organizers was British billionaire Richard Branson.
This concert is all about bringing much-needed relief to Venezuela. It's all about making a difference to the lives of millions who have been suffering for far too long.
The one-day festival recalls the Live Aid benefit concerts back in the 1980s, which raised funds for famine relief in Ethiopia. The goal of this concert is to raise $100 million for relief inside Venezuela, although right now the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is not letting any international aid into the country. And some are skeptical how Branson and his partners could raise that much.
It's unclear how we will raise that or if we will, whether this comes from private donations. In theory, it's less political because it's not coming from the state, it's coming from private investors.
That's reporter Luke Taylor in Cucuta. He says the concert today was free and that many of the attendees were Venezuelans. People were selling water and food and other merchandise in hopes of making some money themselves.
There are merchandise in support of Juan Guaido, who is the opposition leader, Venezuelan hats, tops that say, I'm with Guaido, or I am Guaido, and merchandise with the Venezuelan flag, hats, some flags on sale. A lot of people are actually adorned with the Venezuelan flags and caps.
There are a lot of politics surrounding the concert, but Taylor says that not many at the concert seem to be distracted by that.
Most of the people at the concert actually are already out to enjoy themselves. They told me that they're not going to let the Chavistas ruin their fun. They're going to have a good time regardless. And today's going to be a peaceful day, and that tomorrow the aid is going to go through the border. So it's essentially been optimistic and very hopeful.
But he says others are concerned about the backdrop of this concert.
What's happening at the moment is an international power struggle is taking place here at the border, but also in meeting rooms in the US and in Colombia, Russia, China, etc. And it's playing out here as a form of proxy war. And today it's in the form of music, but tomorrow it will be in the form of aid. And it could be potentially very more dangerous.
Luke Taylor reporting there from Cucuta, Colombia, right on the border with Venezuela. Okay, let's get back to the music that was played at today's Venezuela aid concert there. The lineup included some megastars of Latin American music, like Colombian singers Juanes and Maluma, but also some lesser-known musicians like Remer Amoroso, a refugee from Venezuela. Many in the crowd were waving Venezuelan flags and chanting about freedom. Venezuelan singer and actor José Luis Rodríguez was the first major act to take the stage.
Si quieren venir conmigo a la tierra de las flores, si quieren buscar amores de los que aman de verdad, no dejen que yo me vaya con el corazón vacío, no esperen a que haga frío.
Some of the performers stuck to the hits and got the crowd dancing, but others didn't shy away from political messages, like singer Orlando Valderrama, who sang about an economy being destroyed, a clear reference to the economic meltdown in Venezuela. President Maduro's reaction to today's events? Well, he staged a rival concert on the other side of the border, but the bigger names were at the Venezuela aid concert in Cucuta, including Mexican singer and actress Paulina Rubio. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. At some point, sooner or later, Special Counsel Robert Mueller is going to wrap up his investigation. Exactly when that happens is the subject of much speculation at the moment. But according to news reports, Mueller's team at the Department of Justice is getting ready to hand over its report to the new Attorney General, William Barr. What that report will say exactly and how much of it will even be made public, we don't yet know. But the nearly two-year-long probe into contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia has already told us a lot. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the story, and he's in the studio with me.
Hi, Carol.
And on the line with us from New York is Andrea Bernstein. She's a senior editor at WNYC and the co-host of the excellent Trump Inc. podcast. Thanks for joining us, Andrea.
So great to be with you.
Andrea, let's step back a minute and look at what's come out of Mueller's office so far. It was almost 2 years ago that the investigation was opened. Remind us of how it all began.
Well, it could have gone back even before the campaign when the FBI began to look into Paul Manafort. But specifically with the Mueller investigation, there were allegations during the campaign and after that Russians were interfering with the election and that there were possibly people around Trump that knew about it. That matter is still under investigation. But I think what is extraordinary is how much we know now that we did not know when Mueller was appointed. For example, the president's campaign manager, deputy campaign manager, national security advisor, and personal attorney have all been convicted or pleaded guilty to various crimes, including lying to Congress, bank fraud, tax fraud, and perhaps most startlingly, in the case of his campaign manager, former campaign manager Paul Manafort, conspiracy against the United States. So we've learned a tremendous amount through the indictments of almost three dozen people. Two-thirds of those are Russians, but of the ones who are left, the Americans are senior officials very close to Trump. And that's an extraordinary thing for us to be learning about the people who were once the closest aides to the president of the United States.
And about those Russians, Andrea, one thing that I keep hearing from people that I've been talking to is that the details of those indictments are maybe the most important stuff that we've seen coming from the special counsel's office. This is detailed stuff about individual Russian nationals and sort of how they interfered in the 2016 election. Here's an example. I talked to Seth Hatena. He's the author of Trump Russia, A Definitive History. He started digging into that story for the book in early 2017. And he says back then, a lot of people dismissed the whole Russia story.
You know, there are a lot of jokes about Rocky and Bullwinkle, Moose and Squirrel. Trump had laughed it off as that a 400-pound guy sitting on his bed in New Jersey could have staged the whole Russian interference operation. And now nobody takes that seriously anymore. And that's a result of Robert Mueller.
Andrea, of course, Trump now says that the Mueller investigation is all a big political witch hunt. How have you seen the response, the pushback from the Trump administration change and evolve over the last couple of years?
Well, I think it is really important to say that at this moment, when we are speaking in this sort of penultimate week of February, Mueller has not indicted anybody specifically inside the Trump campaign for colluding with the Russians. However, there have been an awful lot of indictments around that, including the Russian ones we were just talking about. His former campaign advisor, Roger Stone, is charged for lying about his to Congress about his communications or attempted communications with WikiLeaks. So there's an awful lot out there that we now know that I think it's pretty certain that it wasn't just a 400-pound guy in New Jersey. And, you know, we've gone through many, many sets of explanations. No collusion. At one point, the president's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, said, well, if there was collusion, it wasn't Trump. I think he has since walked that back. But there have been a lot of defenses. And Rudy Giuliani's been quite open that his role is a political role and that his primary job is to discredit the Mueller investigation. And in fact, he and the president through his Twitter feed have been working overtime against that. I mean, nobody has been acquitted who's gone through the Mueller process. They've either pleaded guilty or are still on trial and fighting the charges. But he has so far an extraordinary record of racking up guilty pleas of very, very senior people in government and politics in connection with his probe.
Andrea, Mueller's mandate has been to focus on collusion with the Russians, but he's uncovered all kinds of dealings by people close to Trump in the meantime. Describe the branches of this tree. I mean, how big has the overall investigation into Trump grown?
Right. Well, so the charges that Paul Manafort was convicted of initially had to do with his own business relationships with Ukrainians and with Ukrainian oligarchs. But in the course of defending himself, he had contacts with people that Mueller said, or with a person that Mueller said in court filings was a suspected Russian intelligence asset. This individual, Konstantin Kalimnik, was just mentioned in a court hearing last week in which Mueller's prosecutors seemed to be still probing why he and Rick Gates and Paul Manafort had met during the campaign, the height of the campaign, August of 2016. What they discussed, was there an exchange of polling data? And one of the very interesting facts that came up in this court hearing was that Paul Manafort, Rick Gates, and the believed to be spy, Konstantin Kalimnik, all left the cigar bar where they were in Midtown Manhattan through separate exits, as if they were trying to hide the fact that they'd been together.
Some of it's so detailed, it's like ready for a screenplay here. But Andrea, the big question now is what comes next? What are you thinking about in terms of how to sort of place this final report in the context of the big story?
Well, I think it's important to say that we've heard nothing from Mueller's office. It's been an entirely locked box, no leaks, so far as I can tell. All the information we're getting about what's going on in Mueller's office seems to be coming from people who have been on the receiving end of questions or inquiries from Mueller's office. Nor have we heard from the new Attorney General Barr, about what his plans are about releasing what it is that Mueller may give him. So it is an open question what we are going to see and in what form. But what we do know is that there are the ongoing and as of yet unresolved court cases, the ones against the Russians and the court case against Roger Stone. And then in addition, prosecutors in the Southern District of New York are looking into Trump's business dealings. And the New York Attorney General is looking into the Trump Foundation. There are also some civil actions. There's one in Washington and Maryland looking into whether the Trump administration is violating the emoluments clause of the Constitution. So there are many, many trials yet to happen, investigations yet to be concluded that may give us further information about the president's business practices. And one of the things that we've learned is that his business and his campaign and his foundation, all his endeavors, in fact, seem to melt into each other. So if there's an investigation going on of one, the likelihood is that we'll be finding out information about another aspect of the Trump organization in the future.
Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the world's Matthew Bell. Thank you.
Thanks, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills. A low-cost, lightweight Israeli space mission launched last night.
You know, it only weighs a couple of kilograms, but it carries tons and tons of people's dreams and hopes, and it all went up there. And that was actually incredible to see.
What the Braysheet mission shows us about the future of space exploration, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston.
Six, five, Hamesh,
four,
Arba,
three, two, one, zero. Ignition.
Liftoff last night for the Braysheet mission. It's an Israeli spacecraft headed for the moon, and it was boosted into the sky by a SpaceX rocket. If the mission succeeds, it will be a first for a private company. Usually these kinds of missions are funded by governments. This spacecraft was cheaper than anything NASA could build, and smaller too, about the size of a dishwasher. I spoke to Yonatan Weintraub earlier today. He's a co-founder of SpaceIL, the nonprofit behind the mission.
The main engineering concept here is that we want to do commercial off the shelf. We wanted to do it small and lightweight and cheap. And this is what makes this mission cost only $100 million versus the billions and billions of dollars that traditional moon landers usually cost.
And is that to make the point that, yes, we can do this, we can get to space for a lot less money?
So this is a technology demonstrator. We use a lot of very exciting new technologies to lower the cost, starting from commercial off-the-shelf components rather than space-qualified ones. We use 3D printing, and we're also using new orbits. And all that is to show that you can do a space mission, a moon lander, for a lot less than what people have thought is actually possible. Because when the costs come down, we can do a lot more science with that. And, you know, we see also already the fruits of that effort. The NASA administrator tweeted this morning that he is hoping that this type of spacecraft would be more predominant in the future. And our partners, Israeli Aerospace Industries, have already signed an agreement with OHB, which is a German company, to try to make another one of those landers for the European Space Agency and so on. So I hope that this type of designs, cheap, affordable, small missions to other planets, is going to be something that we're going to see a lot more in the future.
So your lunar lander kind of hitched a ride on a SpaceX rocket, and that's how it's getting there?
Yeah, so we basically shared a ride, or kind of Uber of space travel. If you are building a spacecraft, you have two options. Either, and you want to get it to space, either you launch it buying a full rocket, which is very expensive and would probably not be able to do within our mission. So we decided to split the cost with another satellite, a communication satellite that was also launched yesterday on board the SpaceX Falcon 9. And by splitting the cost, we can actually make it affordable for a smaller organization like ours.
Yonatan, where did the idea for this mission come from?
So, you know, three engineers sitting in a bar sketching the first drawings of the spacecraft. That sounds like the beginning of a joke, but this is actually how it happened. Yariv, Kfir, and myself sat down in a bar somewhere in 2010 and thought, why won't we attempt going for the moon? And we registered for our competition. That's called Google Lunar XPRIZE. And we started designing the spacecraft.
Now, you didn't win that initial contest. You entered, but you pursued your idea anyway. Why is the mission so important?
Yeah, so Google decided to cancel the competition after no winner has been able to land on the moon. But we thought that we had something that can actually do something than a lot more than just land on the moon. We're doing this to inspire kids, because kids today, they're not as interested in sciences and engineering anymore. They're much more interested in being celebrities. And we wanted to bring the attention back to the sciences. So we reach out to kids, we tell them about the spaceship, and we see their eyes light up. And this is so important for us to have the next scientists and the next engineers. And for that reason, we decided to continue with this mission.
I understand your spacecraft also includes a time capsule with some interesting contents. Tell us about it.
The time capsule that we're using is about the size of a DVD disc, but it's extremely special because we were able to inscribe into this drawings and pictures of kids that were sent to us from all over the world about sciences and engineering. We included some books and dictionaries and basically a lot of the knowledge of mankind in 2019. And we cranked up like tens of millions of pages into that small space. And as it goes to the moon and rests there, we basically are able to get the dreams of all the people that are involved in this mission on that disc and take it there.
How did you feel watching it leave the launch pad last night?
That was incredible. Yariv and myself started this about 8.5 years ago. And, you know, in the beginning, we thought we were gonna land on the moon, but, it was so far away. As the spacecraft went up, you know, it only weighs a couple of kilograms, but it carries tons and tons of people's dreams and hopes, and it all went up there. And that was actually incredible to see.
Yonatan Weintraub is a co-founder of Space IL. Thanks a lot for speaking with us, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
As if that weren't enough, there's more cool space news to talk about today. Astronomers in Holland have discovered thousands of new galaxies, and the Japanese space program has landed a probe on an asteroid. Bill Harwood covers space news for CBS. He's based near the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Bill, let's focus on the asteroid landing. Where did this take place in space? Take us there.
Well, it's a long way away, believe it or not. 19 light minutes, they say. In other words, it takes radio signals 19 minutes just to make it to the spacecraft. And for a reply, it takes another 19 minutes to get back. So this body is way, way far away from us. It's about 1 kilometer across, or a little bit more than a half a mile in diameter. It was discovered in 1999. And of course, the reason they're studying this is they're very interested in learning more about the original constituents of the solar system. In other words, you know, where did the organic compounds, where did the water come from that led to life on Earth? And they're hoping that by studying pristine bodies like this asteroid, they can gain more clues about the evolution of our solar system. So it's pretty fundamental science.
And the asteroid is just kind of up there in orbit, so they can just aim this probe and it's going to land on it.
Well, that's right. But, you know, when you think about it, it's really remarkable because the gravity of a body this small is minuscule. And, you know, they launched in 2014. They got there in 2018 in June of last summer. And ever since then, they've been flying in close formation with this asteroid. It's Ryugu. And they've been mapping the surface in enormous detail and practicing techniques for collecting samples. And when you say land, that it's not really landing. They basically move in and they're firing a bullet into this asteroid, if you can imagine that. And the impact of that small body kicks up dust and soil, and then the spacecraft scoops up a little bit in this horn-like collector and it backs away. Huh. And that's what it did last night. It went in there, fired the bullet, collected a sample, and backed away. And it's doing all of this autonomously because with a 19-minute delay in communications, there's no way to directly control it. So the software, the electronic brain on the spacecraft has to very carefully fly in formation with this very small body. And to pull this off, and it's quite a feather in their cap. I mean, this is big league science out there in space that so far so good. They've had great success. They're going to try one more sample collection like this later. And then the big finale is they're going to fire what amounts to a bomb into the asteroid, a very small one that's going to blast out a little bit of a crater. And then the spacecraft will move in and try to get some subsurface samples, you know, that are really pristine, that have not been affected by solar radiation,
wow,
things like that, and bring it back to Earth in 2020.
So if I understand you correctly, the spacecraft is kind of hovering near the asteroid and is shooting things out to gather up material from the asteroid.
That's exactly right. And I think more of a hover, if you just think about it, moving in ever so gently, touching the surface and backing away, it's more like that.
Wow.
It's not lingering in contact with the surface. It gets close enough to fire this projectile, scoop up some of the dust that gets blown away, and then back away. And interestingly enough, the spacecraft has already dropped three very, very small landers on the surface. There's one more to go. These things literally hop about, you know, take pictures and make more measurements. So it's not just collecting samples. They're actually down there with these very small landers, three of which, like I said, were deployed previously, collecting data on the surface.
Now, I have a Star Trek question for you. Isn't what they're doing kind of, you know, messing around with the surface of the asteroid, isn't that a violation of the Prime Directive?
Well, it might be if there was anyone there to be bothered by it, but I can assure you there's no one noticing except the flight controllers in Japan who are controlling the spacecraft.
I'm not sure how many people are even aware that Japan has a space program. What can you tell us about it?
Oh, they have a very sophisticated space program. They launch HTV cargo ships to the International Space Station, for example, using Japanese rockets. These are critical to the space station. They carry an enormous amount of supplies. They've been doing that routinely for several years. They launch their own satellites. They have a very sophisticated rocket system, and their science missions are very ambitious. They've had astronomy payloads in orbit. It's all very, very sophisticated science.
We're talking about astronomy, and what about this news that astronomers in Holland have discovered thousands of new galaxies? It's really hard to imagine that.
Yeah, it's a really cool experiment. You know, they have a radio telescope there called the Low Frequency Array. It's known by the acronym LOFAR. Using computers, they can kind of combine the data from all of these very simple antenna elements to come up with images that otherwise, you know, you'd never be able to see. But basically, they're surveying the northern sky, and they've covered about a quarter of it so far. And in the first 10% of that data, they found 300,000 radio sources that hadn't been seen before. And almost all of those, they say, are from previously undetected galaxies. So by the time the survey is finished, they're expecting to find upwards of maybe 15 million radio sources, meaning galaxies.
Wow.
By the time that hadn't been seen before, you know, which is just, I don't know, if you ever felt small before, I sure felt small after reading that, because it's almost like everywhere they look, the sky is filled with galaxies. It's a fascinating observation.
I'm feeling pretty tiny right now.
Welcome to my world.
All right. Bill Harwood covers space news for CBS. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
If you own a cell phone or computer, you've likely had this experience. Something breaks, you go to a local repair shop, like this one in Toronto, Ontario. It's called City Cloud. Clayton Reed is the owner, and he gets lots of customers who come in needing some part of their Apple or Samsung device fixed.
You have two type of parts out there. You have the original and you have the aftermarket. And lots of people, we forced to use the aftermarket, not the original.
That's because Apple and other companies don't want to make those original parts available to independent repair shops and consumers.
If Apple could give the agreement to get the original parts, it'd be beautiful. And Samsung would be the same thing.
One lawmaker in Canada is trying to make that happen.
I believe that major manufacturers have monetized the process, and they've figured out a way to basically hold the customer at ransom when it comes to repairing products.
Michael Cotto represents a district in Ontario. He's introduced legislation to make it easier for consumers to fix their devices on their own or through independent shops.
It was ironic. I was with my daughter on a field trip to an Apple store. And one of the mothers there said that recently she brought her Apple iPad in to replace because the screen cracked. And she got a quote and it was very expensive. So she brought it to a third party. And the third party did the replacement. And a few days later, the screen popped off, like literally popped off the actual device. And she brought it back to them and they complained. The actual person that fixed it said, you know, Apple won't provide us with a specific glue type that's used. And sometimes this happens. We use what, you know, we can get our hands on to. So, you know, the whole point is making sure at the end of the day that manufacturers do provide those parts. And you can compare it to the car industry. And the car industry has been very good at this in releasing parts, releasing manuals, releasing the schematics, diagnostic softwares to their vehicles. Otherwise, you would just imagine going, you know, buying a Ford and only having Ford to go to fix your car.
So what are you proposing? What's in your bill?
So my bill proposes that, first of all, companies should be releasing all of their manuals, their diagnostic softwares, tools, anything that's being used to fix a specific device. And they should be providing those parts, these original parts, to consumers at a reasonable rate.
Are there tech companies that already have that are already doing the right thing and that are providing all this stuff to consumers?
Well,
third party?
I think the entire tech company industry itself was built on that premise, you know, that you could take a part out of a computer, put it back in, and you could change and improve that, you know, for example, PC. And many of the industries and companies that we're talking about now benefited from the fact that amateur engineers went in and made improvements to their devices. But we've seen a growing trend as technology becomes even more and more part of our daily lives. We've seen a growing trend of companies deliberately putting in technology that is difficult to repair.
I know that more than a dozen states here in the U.S. are considering right-to-repair laws. There's also a series of proposals in Europe. How does your proposal compare to those?
Well, mine is the first in this country in Canada, and it's part of that bigger movement. So a lot of the proposals are the same. My proposal will help protect consumers long-term. It would actually amend our Consumer Protection Act here in the province of Ontario.
So if your bill passed, it would only apply to shops and consumers in Ontario?
It would apply to our province of Ontario. But there are some movements in BC and Alberta, other parts of Canada to make changes as well. And perhaps the federal government could look at this as a possible proposal and make that change, a sweeping change right across the country.
Now, I understand you've got a little bit of a problem that your political party, the Ontario Liberal Party, lost a lot of seats in the latest provincial election and no longer has party status. How does that impact the chances of your bill passing?
It is an uphill battle, but I believe that Ontario's politicians, our MPPs, do have the best interest at heart for their constituents.
Michael Cotto represents a district in Toronto, Ontario. Yesterday, he introduced so-called right-to-repair legislation. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you for your time.
One Oscar nomination that's gotten a lot of popular attention is the documentary Free Solo. It's about rock climber Alex Honnold and his epic climb up Yosemite's massive El Capitan. Honnold Spider-Manned up the 3,000-foot granite wall without ropes or safety gear.
Imagine an Olympic gold medal level athletic achievement that if you don't get that gold medal, you're going to die. That's pretty much what free soloing El Cap is like. You have to do it perfectly.
That's one of Honnold's friends, Tommy Caldwell. And while Honnold's achievement is stunning and sort of terrifying on film, the team behind the camera has its own amazing stories to tell. Chai Vassarelli and Jimmy Chin are the husband and wife directors of Free Solo, and they've been adjusting to their newfound fame.
Hi. Hey, Boston.
This is so surreal.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Chai's background is making documentaries in troubled regions around the world. Jimmy is a world-class mountain climber and videographer. Their previous collaboration, Meru, was shot above 20,000 feet in the Himalayas and showed the harrowing risks that Jimmy and two climbing partners took to be the first people to reach the summit of Meru. My colleague Marco Werman talked with the pair about how they look at personal risk for themselves and their film subjects.
Jimmy Chen, Chaya Vassarelli, thanks for being with us. What would you say, Jimmy, is the difference between elite climbers, like the top 1% of climbers, and Alex?
I would say the most distinct difference is Alex's capacity to manage fear and be able to execute perfectly when the stakes are as high as they are.
Look, I don't want to fall off and die either. But there's a satisfaction to challenging yourself and doing something well. That feeling is heightened when you're for sure facing death. You can't make a mistake. If you're seeking perfection, free soloing is as close as you can get.
I mean, you've taken some pretty serious risks as well. What's the difference between you, Jimmy, and Alex?
Well,
I don't know if you can really compare them. They're very, very different.
They're very different.
Is there a concern in your voice? I'm hearing some, what I think is concern.
Well, I think it's just very hard to compare what, like, for example, Meru chronicles Jimmy, Conrad Anker, and Renan Ozturk's expedition to try to climb Mount Meru in the Himalayas. And, you know, they're out there for 18 days straight with a limited supply of food and at 20,000 feet. So it's just a different type of risk.
You know, when we were skiing Everest, there's no margin for error, but it's kind of comparing apples and oranges.
It's choosing a different type of risk to take, I think.
Yeah.
When we skied Everest, he just drops in, you know, casually. You've summited Everest several times, Jimmy, and once you actually skied off the summit?
Yes.
There was a documentary that won Best Oscar, I think, back in the 70s or 80s, A Man Who Skied Down Everest, and I always thought that was just insane.
Yeah, Yichiro Miura. I've met him before.
Really?
He used a parachute, though.
Yes, he used a parachute.
Are you saying he kind of cheated?
Who am I to judge?
Jimmy and Meru, you talk about your background as a child of immigrants.
My parents had to escape from China during the Communist Revolution. They both went through a lot. They came to the United States to make a new life, and I think they had really high expectations for me.
Tell me about your parents. What were their expectations of you growing up?
So they're very traditional. They wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or go into finance. So when I finished university or college, I moved to Yosemite and started climbing full-time and moved into the back of my car and lived as essentially a climbing bum, ski bum, for 7 years.
A dirtbag, as they say in climbing circles.
Yes, I was a dirtbag climber. And they were quite mortified. But eventually, you know, they came to see that that was a good choice for me.
Chai, you're also first generation. How did that, or how has that informed your filmmaking?
My father is Hungarian, but grew up in Brazil. And my mom is from Hong Kong. And I think it just always, like, it always reminded me, or I always knew that there was more out there in the world. Our Chinese background is something that both Jimmy and I share, which is kind of a funny thing because I think we both understand what it's like to be really pushed by our parents. Mm. Academic excellence, this idea of being a doctor or a lawyer, all very familiar to both of us.
Despite that exposure and those experiences growing up, though, I mean, you made your first film in college and then it went on to win Tribeca. That was a movie that followed a group of 20-somethings in Kosovo during the Bosnian War.
I was born in 81, and that is the time when the biggest demonstrations happened in Kosovo.
How did that film come about?
Well, both sides of my family had to flee their home countries because of religious or ideological persecution. So, you know, I was kind of obsessed with those questions and also how do you represent such questions? So when the war in Kosovo broke out in the middle of Europe, like there was genocide in the middle of Europe in the you know, early 21st century, that seemed like an urgent question. And I was very idealistic and probably dumb that, you know, I went there and started making a film. I mean, I was a kid. I was 19, and I went into a war zone. But I understand why I was compelled to go. And that film, you know, the people I met there, the subjects of A Normal Life, their experiences are different from mine, really just because of a passport. They're just as intelligent. They're just as worldly. They just were born in a different place and subjected to political persecution. So, I don't know, it was a very important experience for me.
There is risk, mountain climbing and going into a war zone. How do both of you, Chai and Jimmy, negotiate risk, negotiate each other's risk, negotiate your own risk? And how does having children kind of enter into those calculations?
Well, in terms of Free Solo, the idea of risk is at the heart of the film. Like this idea that if by filming Alex, are we likely to distract him and is he more likely to fall? And it came down to whether or not we believed in Alex and what he was doing. And trying to climb El Cap and putting in the work is his dream, right? He does not want to die, so if he thinks he's going to die, he's not going to go up there. But should he die, he was willing to take that risk because the dream was important enough for him. And, you know, for us, it's like Alex's story is really about, like, the courage to work really, really, really hard and dedicate yourself to pursuing your dream, because then anything is possible.
Chai Vassarelli and Jimmy Chin are the directors of Free Solo, which is nominated for Best Documentary at the Academy Awards on Sunday. They are speaking with the world's Marco Werman. We also have a story about another Oscar-nominated film, Capernaum, whose child star is a refugee from Syria. That's at theworld.org. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg, and The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you on Monday. Have a good weekend, everyone.
PRI, Public Radio International.